Hi, Jonna, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Excellent.
Delighted to hear it.
Sorry?
Delighted to hear it.
Yes. I am secretly plotting to start war with Iran. How about you?
I missed the last meeting of Zog, but hopefully I'll get the minutes soon from that meeting, and I'll be on board, too. Although, I need to be richer.
Yeah, they had some really good cookies. You really missed out.
there's nothing like those warmongering Hamantaschen. Of course, we're sort of referring to the recent dust-up that you had with our friend Matt Iglesias over whether or not Wes Clark was right to say that New York money people or Jews or right-wing Jews or some combination thereof were trying to foment war with Iran.
Right.
Why don't you sort of walk us through it since you were in the trenches, and then I'll sort of chime in.
Right. Well, we should probably get him onto one of these shows so he can rebut me so it's not purely one-sided. But
sure.
What Clark said was he was... Now, first of all, this is all based on comments that were published in the Huffington Post, which I do not regard as the most rigorous journalistic outlet. So it's entirely possible that Clark was misquoted or quoted out of context.
Fair enough.
So this is all premised on the assumption that he was quoted correctly and not wildly out of context.
Right, and he could have clarified the record, to be sure, right? I mean, if
that's right.
This has been going on for quite a while now, and if he was quoted that inaccurately, he could come clean or set the record straight, and to my knowledge, he has not, right?
He has not, although this is not the most media-savvy guy who's ever lived either, so...
Sure,
you know,
okay.
All right, but I think it's probably what he said was probably true, at least so I'm willing to work on that assumption. What he said was that he was talking about how there's going to be war with Iran, and he was asked, how do you know? And he said, because basically the New York money people, basically the, you know, rich Jews are pushing for it. And my argument, Matt said, well, this is not anti-Semitic, I mean, because everything he said is obviously true. Obviously, there are these rich Jews and obviously these... organizations that they belong to or are pushing for war, and has evidence of the fact that they were pushing for war. He said that, you know, they're all talking in alarmed and heated tones about the potential of Iran obtaining a nuclear bomb. My response was, A, it's not necessarily true that being alarmed about Iran means you're pushing for war. And in fact, Matt makes this exact point today, not seeming to realize that this confusion is one that he himself has been propagating. That I, for instance, am very alarmed about the prospect of a nuclearized Iran, but I don't think an American military strike or even necessarily an Israeli one would help things. I think it would at best delay things a short period of time while politically making reform and negotiation much more difficult with Iran, and in the long run probably hasten of getting a bomb. So I'm against the strike, but the main point, I think, is that what was truly objectionable and creepy and weird about Clark's comments was his assumption that because Jews, or a tiny number of Jews, are for war, that means we will have a war. And there's no other interpretation of his comments as they were transcribed in the Huffington Post. And so... if you believe that, you don't just believe that there is a Jewish lobby, that there's a pro-Israel lobby, that this has a lot of power in American life, which is true. What you believe is that this lobby essentially controls the American government, and that it's capable of not just affecting, you know, American aid to Israel, which it is, but it's capable of, you know, forcing a war that otherwise wouldn't happen. And that's just, you know, nuts.
It's not going to shock you. I think you have, I mean, I like Matt Iglesias, and I think, you know, he's one of the best your side has on a lot of stuff, but...
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, he's great.
But at the same time, I think his position is kind of muddled, and I think he got himself into a bad corner, which you sort of noticed, which is that the argument that Jews have the power to do this just feeds directly into the anti-Semitic trope that they're the string pullers behind the scenes, going back to the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and all that kind of thing. But what kind of drives me crazy about these arguments about Jews pushing foreign policy one way or the other is that, of course, it's a dual loyalty argument, but what bothers me is there's this implied assumption that when Jews are agitating or are pushing or arguing in a democratic society that somehow they don't have the best interests of America at heart. You know, there are lots of people who spent time living in Europe, and they take Europe's perspective into account, and no one thinks that, you know, John Kerry, who cares deeply about what Europe thinks of him in America, no one thinks that he cares more about Europe than he does about the better, you know, what's good for the United States of America. Nobody thinks that African-Americans who care deeply about the plight of Africa somehow don't care about America or are arguing for things against America's interest. They argue
right.
that doing what they think is right is in America's interest. And for some reason, Jews get singled out as the group who not only are pushing America to do something that's not in our interest, but that they sort of know it and they don't care, and that they
right.
care more about Israel than they do about the United States. And I simply
right.
have never met that Jew. I know a lot of, you know, pro-Israel Jews. I know a lot of Jews who are probably in favor of going to war with Iran. But I haven't met a single one who has ever said, in any context ever, you know, it would be bad for America but good for Israel, so we should get America to do it. And implicit in all these sorts of things is that Jews operate that way, that right-wing Jews or left-wing Jews, for that matter, operate in a way that, where they're willing to do things that are bad for America to for the betterment of some, of their kindred spirits in Israel, and they don't. I've just never run into those Jews who argue that way or who think that way, even in those secret meetings that, you know, we joke about going to.
Well, I agree with that, but let me just make two caveats to this. Number one, the fact that they don't admit it doesn't mean that it's not operating at some level. I mean,
sure,
I've never met a business lobbyist who thinks, you know, who will admit that they're trying to get some special break or some other lobbyist that's against the national interest. They're always able to persuade themselves it is. So I think that psychology could be working, where people are thinking about what's best for Israel and convincing themselves it's best for the United States, even if, you know, they're not necessarily thinking very rigorously about that. Number two, it's true that there is, you know, a Jewish lobby that has a lot of influence over, you know, American Middle Eastern policy, especially in Congress. I would say less so in the White House. But and I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, expressing concern about that, especially if you don't agree with what they want. But, you know, at some point, you know, it's hard to say where the leap between sort of a fair analysis of what that power is and stops, and where it begins to go into, you know, just kind of crazed conspiratorial territory. I think Clark's comments were surely over the line. I mean, there are a lot of issues, I think, where there's a fuzzy line between, you know, analysis and just racism and bigotry. You know, you can look at issues like, you know, the IQ gap between blacks and whites, which, I mean, at some level there, you know, there's a gap. It's a legitimate issue. I think at some point you start, when you try to describe it as a kind of a function of genetic differences, I think that's when you tend to go, A, beyond the fact, and B, into, you know, racism. You know, actually, I think there's a kind of parallel between, you know, some of the people who do that. You know, I would put Charles Murray in that category. Murray will start off by saying legitimately that there are a lot of people on the left who want to shut down all debate about intelligence or, you know, affirmative actions and talk about political correctness. And he's right about that to a point. But then he'll use that to present himself as a hero, and then he'll put forth some, you know, pretty shoddy research and ideas and try to, you know, rely on an amen corner who will, you know, lionize everything he says because he's willing to stand up to the PC crowd.
I would defend Charles as a pretty rigorous guy, and I would defend Charles, but I don't want to have a debate about Charles Murray right now. But I think you're right about the dynamic. I think that political correctness on both right and left has this tendency to sort of feed these self-anointed truth tellers. And, you know,
right.
I think a better and more relevant example to what we're talking about is Jimmy Carter. You know, this morning on NPR, I heard Jimmy Carter say to NPR, you know, I've been called an anti-Semite, I've been called a bigot, I've been called a plagiarist. Well, regardless of whether the charges of bigotry or anti-Semitism are right or wrong, the charge of plagiarist is a pretty simple factual issue. And
right.
I thought it was sort of interesting how he throws it in there to sort of say that calling me a plagiarist is as illegitimate as calling me an anti-Semite. And he goes around pretending that he is uniquely, you know, that he is this special hero who's speaking truth to power about
right.
Israel, and that he's being silenced all over the place, particularly at heavily Jewish schools was his argument a couple of weeks ago. And that sort of environment allows him to sort of say, sort of a Chomsky-eyed thing, where once you sort of designated yourself as the guy breaking the taboo, you get to go, you get to run a lot further downfield than the facts will allow, and your side, including a lot of nasty people, will get your back because they want you to sort of get this stuff out there and make those sorts of attacks.
Right. Yeah. I think we're in agreement about that.
But it's interesting, since you're talking about sort of the Charles Murray and the race stuff and all of that, it kind of brings us to something that we were chatting about briefly beforehand, which was the sort of the issue of racial authenticity. And how it's sort of playing out in this race with a guy who's got a much better chance to be president than Wes Clark does, Barack Obama.
Right.
And at least my view, which I was talking about quite a bit on our blog at the corner yesterday, and I have to do some follow-ups because I got some good email from some liberal people taking exception. Mm-hmm. What sort of I find fascinating was yesterday's Washington Post piece, which was sort of a capper on this conversation that's been going on for a while, talks about Obama's trouble with the black vote. And what I found sort
or potential trouble, right.
I'm sorry?
Or potential trouble.
Trouble, fair enough, right. And what I found sort of dismaying about the piece was how cavalierly and without any anticipation of the idea that somehow this might be controversial, they sort of worked on the sort of background assumption that because Obama was academically successful and professionally successful and because he lived in a mixed racial neighborhood, that he wasn't authentically black enough for the black leadership or the black vote or a combination of the two. And that sort of discussion of race was, I'm not saying it's not true, because clearly a lot of people think it is, and that's sort of in politics, if they think it is, then it is. But it's kind of depressing nonetheless.
Extremely depressing. And I thought the article was a little bit too credulous towards, it was more describing that attitude than defending it, but it could have put a little bit more pressure on it. And, you know, the other factor you didn't mention was that because he has a lot of support from whites, this makes him inauthentic.
Right, of course, is
a formula for political marginalization. When your community only represents 11% of the public, you need your leaders to have a lot of support for whites to get a majority. You can't get anything done if you're not a majority in this country. So if the fact that you're a majority is itself discredits you, this means the only authentic leaders will be ones who fail. That was really awful and terribly depressing.
I mean, and there are some cynical points to be made, which is that a lot of the black leadership, you know, particularly the self-anointed sort of rabble-rousing leadership, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and those guys, they can't necessarily be looking at Obama with nothing but unbridled joy, because the extent to which that dysfunctional dynamic of sort of saying embrace your marginality, embrace your the racist narrative beyond its utility, if that happens, if you know Obama becomes the first black president of the United States, the relevance of people like Jackson and Sharpton plummets. And I think that would be healthy for everybody, for black America, for white America, for the United States of America. I think it would be wonderful. I mean, I'm not going to vote for Barack Obama because I don't think voting simply because it would be good for America to have a black guy is a good enough reason for me, given everything else he believes. But so far, I think Obama is an incredibly healthy phenomenon, and I think he's an admirable guy personally.
Mm-hmm. You know, and let me slightly partisanize this discussion. I think I'm about to,
fair enough.
Because there's a point about education. You know, you said he's inauthentic. The attack, the anti-intellectual attacks on him. He's inauthentic. He went to Harvard. He's out of touch with this. I think that's an incredibly destructive message in the black community, especially where in so many communities, there's a stigma against academic achievement. But I think to a lesser but still very real degree, it's a harmful message in the white community as well, to stigmatize that. But of course, that's been a staple of conservative and Republican rhetoric for quite a long time. You know, you can remember George Bush attacking Michael Dukakis being at the Harvard boutique, and the anti-intellectual attacks that George W. Bush was making on Al Gore, and the general, you know, conservative attacks on Harvard, the Ivy League, et cetera, et cetera. So the funny thing is that there's a pretty strong parallel between the attacks from Obama as an Ivy League elitist from the left as the same attacks that are made on the white liberal elite by the right.
It's a fair point. Where I would sort of part way on it is, one, I'm not fond of the Republican Party's move towards populism. And I have tried to write this several times that I am not anti-elitist. I'm just anti the current elite. And so I think a lot of people understand when, you know, when Papa Bush, a product of Yale and Skull and Bones and all the rest, was attacking Harvard Yard, he wasn't necessarily attacking educational achievement per se. He was attacking the certain cultural milieu that comes out of Cambridge. And I have no problem attacking those people. The dynamic in Black America strikes me as far more dangerous because the whole sort of acting white when doing well in school to begin with. And that's right. The dangerous part. But I'll agree with you. There is a certain parallel. I don't think, in fairness, that the Black community is picking up that message from the populist right. I don't think that they're thinking that Harvard is bad and white because because Ralph Reed is saying so. That's not where that message is coming from.
I think it's a natural parallel that sort of organically grew out. And I think it's probably something that Richard Hofstadter would have a lot to say about, but I know you don't like him very much.
I have my problems with them. Yeah. I forgot what I was going to say. I'm having actually a little hard time hearing you. I don't know if you're not talking loud or if you're not talking into your phone or if you're reading in Danish, but I just thought I'd let you know.
Is that better?
That's a lot better.
My microphone.
That's enormously better.
Okay. Good.
I appreciate it.
Sure.
It's interesting. I mean, it's interesting. The Republican, just as a side note on populism for a second, the Republican Party, or the conservative movement, does not argue a lot. There are people who argue this way. John O'Sullivan and a few argue for more populism in the Republican Party. But it hits a lot of resentment because populism is, for I think obvious reasons, mostly associated, at least on the right, with economic populism, which, for obvious reasons, my crowd doesn't like. And you guys all the time are writing about how important populism is. The guys of the American Prospect seem to think populism is the way out. They love John Edwards. John Judas has written for you guys and elsewhere some really powerful stuff in favor of how populism is the sort of the Rosetta Stone for all the Democratic Party's problems. So if we're sort of partisanizing this a bit, it's worth pointing out that you guys have similar issues on that front, too. Your targets aren't Harvard, they're the boardroom, but it's still, my view on populism is that it's almost always dangerous, and once you let it out of its cage, you don't know who it's going to attack. But that's me.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to debate populism as opposed to something. I mean, we were specifically having a debate about anti-intellectualism, which is a more specific thing. Populism is a pretty broad thing that means so many different things to so many different people. I think we spent an hour debating about what it actually meant before we actually got down to debating, whether it's good.
Sure.
But populism just means so many things. So I'm sure you could find a lot of examples of liberals arguing for populism. But sometimes populism, at least in the press, it just means a politician with a common touch who can relate to people well. And I don't see anything objectionable about that. I think more broadly it refers to discussing economics in terms that recognize that not all economic classes have done well at the same rate or equally well or well at all over the past, 5, 10, 20 years or whatnot. Talking about not pretending that the class differences don't exist or not pretending that class differences aren't part of policymaking in Washington, and I'm in favor of that as well. Then you can move on to sort of more extreme versions, and that's where the support tends to melt away in elite quarters, and that's where it also tends to get more objectionable, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, ironically, I hadn't planned on making this point, but Matt Iglesias' position is classically populist, that there are, whether they're Jews or they're rich people or they're rich Jews or British bankers, whoever it is, but there are these people in these star chambers behind the scenes who are sending the poor either to their death or to a lifetime of drudgery and hard labor while they benefit from it for their own purposes. I mean, that is a classically populist view that goes back to the American 19th century, you know, perfectly. And I think it's sort of interesting how these sort of ideas keep popping back up. But.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And it's actually sort of, you know, I think the whole debate in the first one we were talking about kind of makes the point that I think people made originally, I think that you're making also, that there is this danger of, you know, you. I think the reason there's been a stigma about talking about things, you know, like Jewish political power is people fear that once you start, then, you know, you open a genie, then all kinds of crazy, ugly sentiments pop out.
Right.
So you
right.
can start off by having a legitimate discussion about a real phenomenon that you can, you know, you can really object, you can object to the Jewish lobby for perfectly valid non-anti-Semitic reasons.
Right.
But it actually, and that's what I think too. You should be able to do that, and then just draw the line at the when you get to the ugly stuff. But the problem is, you know, it's kind of going exactly the way you would predict. You're starting with a legitimate discussion, and it's getting into ugly stuff pretty fast, and
right.
a lot of people on the left are losing the distinction between the two.
Right. No, I think that's exactly right. Since we talked briefly about economic populism and all the rest. I wanted to sort of bring up the piece you did on Alan Reynolds, and I guess I don't know if it's I guess there's a new issue out today, which I have not seen, but
right.
The last issue I saw, which was last week's issue, and
TNR, yeah.
And I have a sort of a specific complaint, which sort of gets us to all this stuff. I am not here. I have no brief for Alan Reynolds. You know a lot. You know, you've studied his arguments a lot more, and. All the rest, and I'm not going to get into it. I don't want to get into a wonky argument about the nature of income inequality and all that, although I'll engage if I have to. What kind of bothers me about the piece is that it seems there are a couple stolen bases in there where you leap to making conclusions and assertions about Alan Reynolds' motives, where you talk about how he sort of you know, his job, first of all, the whole piece is premised on the idea that he's trying to muddy the waters and confuse people about income inequality just to make it a confusing issue so that no one knows what the right answer is and all the rest. And that serves his purposes. That serves, you know, you have a line in there, something about how, you know, some rich guy who or heir to some fortune, you know, needs a think tank hack, as you call Alan. To muddy these waters so that, you know, that the right policies won't be implemented.
And well, that was actually a jokey hypothetical example, but it was meant to be redolent of Reynolds. Well, why don't we back up and first explain to those who may not have read the article yet what my article was about. It was about Alan Reynolds, who is a scholar at Cato Institution, and his role, one of his main roles in American life, is to jump up and down anytime, you know, any study comes out demonstrating the rise of income inequality and say, no, it's not happening at all. You know, he was doing this about rising income inequality in the 80s, and this was just, in his mind, it was just a slur against Ronald Reagan by embittered liberals. And now he's actually conceding that inequality, he's quietly conceding that inequality did rise in the 1980s, but he's saying it's not rising anymore. So that's my argument. So go back to your critique, just so.
Yeah, I'm glad you did that. We should have started there. But my problem was is that there was zero evidence about what his motives are. There was lots of evidence about why his arguments were wrong and fair enough, but there was zero evidence, at least that I saw, about what his motives are. And yet that was the central. That was the central thrust of your piece, is that he's doing this all in bad faith. And in many ways, that's a populist argument, too. It's this assumption that the people on the side of economic power and privilege and all the rest are doing things as sort of mustache-twirling villains to hurt the little guy. And I just want to know sort of what your response to that observation, criticism, whatever you want to call it, would be.
Yeah, you know, I need to go back and look at it. To what extent I talked about his actual motives, I don't know. I know that is his role in American life. I mean, that's his role in this debate, is to muddy the waters. That's what he does. You know, to say that he's setting out to muddy the waters consciously. I don't know if I said that.
But I'll take another look. That was the way it came across to me pretty
right.
pretty clearly.
I mean, that's what he does. And the point is that the, in these kinds of debates, there are inevitably people like Alan Reynolds, and what they do is muddy the waters, and they have a particular style. And that was what I was talking about. I was writing. There's a particular style that recurs in their arguments about, you know, the people who deny evolution and people who deny global warming. There's a particular way in which they frame their arguments that always has the same effect. It's always done the same way. They're less interested. That particular person is less interested in constructing their own coherent theory of what happened than just, you know, immersing themselves in the details and finding various little flaws and anomalies with the data. When actually the experts, you know, understand those anomalies, but don't think it really changes the big picture. And then he leaps from that to asserting that the data is totally inconclusive. We don't know the answer, and so this phenomenon must not exist.
That's fair. I mean, I would argue, you know, as sort of a observer, you know, I've been going through a lot of economic history of liberalism lately, and I would sort of say, as I sort of said, that your argument, again, regardless of the merits of the factual stuff, right. also fits a style, which is to sort of make it seem as if people who deny the complaints or try to mitigate the complaints of economic populists are doing so out of a desire simply to protect the rich and the powerful and protect their own interests. It's not quite Marxist, but it's sort of Beardian, you know, in this economic, you know, motives and incentives and self-interest drive everybody. And again, I just don't, you know, but I don't know Alan Reynolds very well. I went to college with his daughter, but, you know, I haven't seen her in 10 years. But the idea that somehow, you know, the guys on the right, you know, and I get this, you find this all over the place, not just you, we can broaden it out. I mean,
right.
half the email I get from left-wingers assumes that if I'm wrong about a fact or if they have a different interpretation about the facts, that I must be lying, not incorrect or coming at it from a different perspective. And all of the sort of rising economic populism arguments that you hear from liberals and the left are all grounded in this sort of Thomas Nast cartoon understanding of human motivation, that maybe, you know, that the idea that rich people are simply out there to get richer. And you saw a lot of it with the Halliburton stuff and the Don Rumsfeld stuff, as if these guys were in government to get richer off of more oil, even though they were hugely rich already. And that style of argument kind of leaves me cold, is my only point.
Right. Let me explain what I think. I mean, obviously, there are people who think the way you're describing. I would say that they're more marginal than you would. And I think maybe you're confusing that kind of the fact that you're confusing my analysis for that kind of analysis means to me that you're probably missing a distinction. And let me explain what I think
okay.
and why I think you're confusing what I'm saying with that.
Okay.
What I think is that there are people out there who are interested in funding policies or are at least naturally attracted to policies that benefit them personally and can very easily convince themselves that those policies are good and right when they dovetail with their own personal financial self-interest. So as a result, you have, you know, lots of funding for people like Alan Reynolds or for people who will, you know, make arguments that benefit elites much more than, whereas, and many of those people are not actually good scholars. You know, if they were making arguments about topics that didn't happen to have repercussions that benefited rich people, I think they would be, you know, sitting in a basement somewhere with a single swing light bulb writing for a very, very small audience. Or, you know, now I guess these days they'd be writing for a blog, but that would be it. So I don't think it's purely coincidental that, you know, that there are a lot of extremely bad scholars out there who make arguments that happen to, you know, benefit have implications that benefit very, you know, rich people. I think mostly it's a process of self-delusion that goes on. It's very easy to convince yourself that things that are in your self-interest are, or that you're inclined to believe, you know, are good for the country as well.
Yeah, it sort of, again, we're getting a lot of synergy here. This sort of dovetails with the point you were making earlier about sort of pro-war or neocon or hawkish Jews. You know, it's not that they're acting in bad faith, is that their biases become self-confirming when they look around. And I have no, mm-hmm. you know, I have no problem believing that that dynamic is certainly out there. But what bothers me at the bottom is and I'm not trying to lay this entirely at your feet because I take you at your word that that was not your intention, but the, and maybe I just misread you, but what bothers me is this sort of, this assumption of bad faith on the part of people who disagree, and, you know, it's sort of a bugaboo of mine, and...
Well, I think there. Look, I'll be honest, I think there is, you know, some bad faith in Alan Reynolds. I think there's evidence of it. You know, he had a line there, and I quoted in my piece where he said, "Oh no, you know, actually, I was going to quote it, and I think it got cut for space at the end." But he talked about how he, you know, people were taking the implication of one thing, but he wrote somewhere, "I very carefully did not say this." So he was leaving the implication of this, but as he wrote somewhere, "I very carefully did not say X." And he very carefully did it because he was trying to leave this impression without quite saying it. That's not really what a disinterested scholar does.
Fair enough. You know, if that's what he did, I mean, if that's what he did, then shame on Alan. But and I guess the distinction I would draw is, I mean, whether, you know, there's a difference between polemicists and scholars, and I guess that's a distinction that should be made, and fair enough. I mean, I just don't know enough about the actual argument, and I'm actually one of these people who's willing to say, yes, I think income inequality is rising, and the extent to which it's a problem is where you and I would have an argument, you know.
Right. I mean, let me just make one more point in my defense of this. There was a debate at Heritage at Cato on Reynolds' paper, and Gary Bertlis, who's an economist who studies this stuff at Brookings, and I think is a very, very rigorous and fair-minded and not terribly ideological guy. And he was debating Reynolds and said, "Your paper reads like a lawyer's brief. You basically cherry-picked out all the facts that would try to lead the reader towards one conclusion, and you've, you know, kind of stacked the deck with your headline to lead the layperson to a single conclusion, and it doesn't read like a fair-minded attempt to actually look at what's going on with income inequality." So, you know, I think... Yeah, you know, I think to some extent he was acting in bad faith. He was trying to drive the reader towards a conclusion. He wasn't sitting out trying to say what's the most accurate research on income inequality. He was cherry picking. Yeah. So,
okay.
Yeah,
I mean, that's fair. I mean, and I certainly take you at your word that is your rational and studied conclusion after looking at all of this. I don't know enough about all of it, but it sounds like you got a good case on your hands.
Okay.
Speaking of conferences and think tanks and all of the rest, didn't you do something on one of my favorite subjects last night on fusionism?
Fusionism, my God, we could be going for hours on this. They've got to stop us. But yes, there was a debate last night. The America's Future Foundation held it, but it was on the premises of the Heritage campus in downtown Washington. So it was sort of two parallel debates going on at once. One was between David Boaz and your colleague Ramesh Panuru, and one was between Brink Lindsay and me. But basically what it ended up being was me and Ramesh against David and Brink, which is kind of an interesting
sounds about right, yeah.
But it was about, so to introduce the readers to it, it was Brink Lindsay wrote an essay, which I think is actually based on a book that's going to be coming out this spring.
Yeah, I just read the galley, actually, yeah.
Oh, I'd like to read it myself. He's a really smart, interesting guy. And I thought his piece for TNR was really thought-provoking. I'm really glad we wrote it. I disagreed with it, and I wrote a response to it. But, I thought it was a great smart piece. But he basically wrote that libertarians aren't getting anything out of their alliance with the right, and they need to start thinking about a new fusionist alliance along the lines of their fusionist alliance with the right, with the left. Left libertarian fusionism. And he further argued, and here is where I think it started to get objectionable and unconvincing, that liberalism is kind of morbid and dead, and Jimmy Carter, et cetera, and that the libertarian vote is really important, crucial swing block that liberals need to woo, or Democrats really need to woo, or they'll be consigned to the minority. And that's where I especially disagreed with it. But why don't you jump in at this point?
Oh, okay. I wrote a response to Brink's piece, too. I agree with you entirely that Brink is a smart and engaging and interesting guy. And I sort of have an odd approach to this. I think that tactically, you're wrong in the sense that I think liberals would be smart to try and figure out a fusionism thing. But at the same time, I think... philosophically, you're absolutely right, and so is Ramesh, And so are most of the libertarian and conservative critics of Brink's position, which is that it can't be done. The problem is Aesopian. You know, the scorpion has to sting the frog because that's what scorpions do. Liberalism has to intrude where it sees, you know, injustice that it thinks it can fix. I mean, we're not going to get back to our pragmatism versus dogmatists thing, but you know, I think liberals have to use the state for ends that they find desirable, and libertarians have to not do that, you know, as much as possible. And so it's very difficult to put the two together. I mean, what I think is fascinating as a conservative is how much libertarianism is changing. I mean, there's all this pissing and moaning and bitching and whining from libertarians about how much conservatism is changing, and some of it is fair and a lot of it is exaggerated, but, you know, there's no lack of attention being paid to the rise of social conservatives and Christian conservatives and all the rest. But because libertarians are more marginal and less homogeneous politically and intellectually, no one's paying attention to the fact that libertarianism is changing dramatically. And if you read Brink's piece, if you read the stuff by Will Wilkinson and some other folks, these guys are switching to a kind of a liberal Deweyan position of emphasizing positive liberty, you know, and that the state can create the conditions where they take care of your needs, and therefore you get to pursue your wants as much as you like, which is a very Dewey sort of position and would have to be the grounds where you and the libertarians would meet. But that's very difficult to do.
I can see the beads of sweat forming on your forehead as you say this.
I'm sorry?
I said I can see the beads of sweat forming on your forehead as you describe this horrifying vision of positive liberty. But go on.
Well, no, I mean, I think it's, you know, I have obviously big problems with positive liberty, but I think it's a sign. If you look at, like, what Virginia Pastrell's book on the substance of style, if you look at my buddy Ron Bailey's book on biotechnology, these guys are looking to technology and consumerism and all of these things. And if you look at how Reason has changed as a magazine, looking at sort of empowering the individual. You know, Nick Gillespie talks a lot about how libertarians are in favor of individuals leaving, exiting systems that no longer serve them, which is like, you know, which includes tradition, traditional morality, all of that sort of thing. And so you can see why someone like Brink, who's very much, you know, a liberal on a lot of the social issues and a lot of the sort of a lot of that sort of thing. And if all of a sudden you think positive liberty gets you closer to the sort of human liberation than the negative liberty stuff does, then there is a sort of philosophical interesting ground. There's some yeastiness for you guys to get together. I just don't think it can happen, at least anytime soon. But it's an interesting way of sort of looking at how libertarianism changes. Because it's inconceivable that Frank Meyer or any of those guys would have ever thought of a fusionism between libertarianism and, you know, and sort of progressive liberal FDR liberalism. I mean, it's apples and oranges. And now it's not apples and oranges. It's a hard fit, but it's you know, it's an interesting fit.
Right. You know, one of the other things is that Frank Meyer and fusionism, I think a lot of liberals regarded that as a kind of cynical compromise. I mean, it was an attempt by conservatives and libertarians to convince each other that there was a very natural fit between the two ideologies when the fit was a lot less natural than they wanted it to be, and that worked for the purposes of forming a political coalition. But I don't really see it as the job of people like me to form a political coalition. To, you know, slightly shade my views so that, you know, it works well with my libertarian friends. So part of the problem I had was just the whole kind of, what I think, misguided, or at least not a good fit for me and other people like me. You know, idea that we should be, you know, that you should kind of trim your sails or try to, you know, like, that you have to not just believe what you believe, but you have to, like, make what you believe and what other people believe, you know, fit together somehow.
No, I think that there's some fairness there. I mean, the way I always sort of viewed fusionism is that it's sort of a Sorelian myth. It's this thing that is a perfect ideal for conservatives and libertarians to push towards, but in the real world, you know, it doesn't actually work that well. But and one of the things, I mean, I thought where you were going was to sort of talk about civil rights and how I was cynical on that front. I don't think that's necessarily the case for a lot of people who believe in fusionism, but that was certainly at work. And one of the things that fusionism allowed was to have a small federal government, but to actually have fairly coercive or, you know, certainly in the case of civil rights, tyrannical systems in the South, but also other sort of systems of just sort of allowing community standards, community mores, that kind of thing to prevail. And right. And so that republicanism is sort of has been sort of bled white in modern America, that libertarians don't care about it anymore, and what they really want is personal liberty rather than community, the liberty of communities to live as they want. They now want sort of radical individual liberty, and or at least some of them do. And so the terms of what fusionism rested on no longer really apply in today's sort of system.
Can I make a small and slightly obnoxious point, which is that I see that you've been so tormented by the left about National Review's shameful history and civil rights that you now have been trained into bringing it up yourself without even being prompted by someone else. So I don't even have to do it anymore. I just have to edge vaguely near the topic, and I can sort of goad you into doing it yourself. So you've been completely spooked on this, and I'm glad to see it.
Fair enough. Yeah, my flinch mechanism is such that I can't help myself. Although the last time I did Blogging Heads, I got into a fairly heated thing with Ann Outhouse about all of this, and and her...
You're obviously traumatized.
Yeah, I was, because her sanctimony and piety on the issue was too much to bear. But
somehow you go on.
I persevere, because that's, you know, that's the kind of guy I am. Is there anything else that we want to chat about?
No, I think I'm getting hungry. Your insistence on holding this afternoon has created a limit on my endurance here, and so I've got to go get food.
Fair enough. I hope that you don't get too beaten up for agreeing with me so much.
Before we conclude, for those who don't know, I spent much of my day yesterday in a blog war with the left, and I just feel out of whack, and I feel like I need to be attacked from the right, which is one of the reasons I was looking forward to this, and you've kind of disappointed me in that regard, and so I don't know. I mean, I really want you to just kind of, I just want like the full McCarthyite, you know, go after me, question my loyalty to America, you know, insinuate that I'm gay, you know, call me a pinko. I need that, you know, right now. I just, to be in balance, you know.
Hey, you know, Jonathan, if these are the things that you feel vulnerable of and that you want the right to attack you on, that's fine. But I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to jump to that. I think you're a patriotic, fully manly individual.
Thanks, Jonah. Thank you. That's just perfect.
And one
when
of these
I need
days,
you, when I need you to attack me, there's no, you're nowhere to be found when I need you to attack me. And yet, when I don't need it, you know, you're all too willing to comply.
Yeah, it's my ninja-like ability to sneak up on you. All right, well, you have a great weekend. I got to go off to this conservative summit, and nice chatting.
You may reach the mountaintop, but I won't be able to go there with you.
Fair enough. Bye.
Okay.